Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Sevilla, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Dan Bednarz about his excellent new book, East German Intellectuals and the Unification of Germany, an Ethnographic View, published by Palgrave in 2017. Dan, hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you this morning. We'd like to begin all these interviews by having you, the author, tell us a little something about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm a trained sociologist, although my PhD is actually in public policy analysis. My research interests have always been, from my dissertation to this book on Germany to the book I'm working on now, about how entities, organizations, etc., responses to decline. And it takes off sort of from Albert O. Hirschman's famous book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. So that's basically who I am and what I've done in my intellectual career.
And where do you teach now?
I am retired and I'm now teaching at Bristol Community College. So I teach part-time there.
And sociology courses?
It's sociology. I did spend part of my career in public health, but I teach sociology courses and mostly principles of sociology, which is a very difficult class to teach, and social problems, which is a very enjoyable class to teach.
And how do you find teaching at a community college as opposed to a big research university?
It's challenging. I'd say I had this conversation with a couple of colleagues at University of Michigan about a month ago, and they said, yes, same thing. And I said, well, you know, about 15 to 20% of the students could be at Michigan or any other major and well-regarded university. About 30 to 40% of them, maybe 50%, are really good kids. And with some encouragement, they can keep up. And then there's about 10 to 15% maybe, who really shouldn't be there. They're there because they have no place else to go. And they're good kids, but, you know, if you're not prepared, it's just so difficult to step into that world and start performing at a college level.
Sure, sure. So let's turn to the particular book at hand. How did you come to write this book?
Well, quite by chance, a serendipity. In 1990, I went to Berlin with my wife, my then wife, and our two children, and she was on sabbatical and was invited to a research center in Berlin. And as a courtesy, they gave me an appointment too, and they said to me, oh, do whatever you want. And I was going to study how the introduction of personal computers, which was just entering the world at that time, would affect organizational structure, power, interactions in Germany. But the first day I was there, I found myself, quite by chance, invited into East Berlin, which was only going to exist for 6 more weeks. This was 6 weeks before the unification. And I was invited to speak to a group of scholars studying English at the Academy of Science. And that's how it got going. I went there and spoke to them, and we really got along well, and they all wanted to talk to me for two reasons. One is I could speak English, and they all wanted to learn English, native English, even though it was American, not British English, and they wanted to tell their story about what was happening to them, how their identity and careers were being upended. They didn't use those terms, but they were just talking about the Wende, the turn, and how it was affecting their lives as East German intellectuals. And so I, after a few weeks of going to the class and having coffee with them, et cetera, and speaking to colleagues in West Berlin at the Institute, I discovered that there was no one studying these people, which astounded me. I'd always had an interest in the sociology of science, and not only was no one studying them, for the most part in the West, these were despised people because they were considered communist apologists and, you know, that corrupt people, et cetera.
Okay. I was very struck by when you were talking to these people, their constant use of the word "the turn." I'm wondering if you can describe to our listeners what you mean by this, what they meant by this, how they sort of manifested in their minds, and how it sort of impacted their day to day.
So this concept, the turn, was presented to me. They start talking about the turn in that first meeting with them, and I said to the teacher afterwards, "What's the turn?" She said, "Oh, it's the turn away from socialism towards capitalism, and it means change. It means the massive change, but they call it Wende, turn." And so everyone used this concept, the turn, and they also used another concept, Abwicklung, which means, it's a little hard to translate, but it means unwinding, liquidation, winding things down, shutting things down, dismantling. But Wende is the term, although some of them objected to the term Wende. They said it was really a takeover, and so they would use this word Abwicklung, but they never used a German word for takeover. But Wende was the term that came to be, if you ask any German the Wende, they know exactly what you're talking about. Fall of the Berlin Wall, which several months later led to the unification of Germany.
Okay, and was this something they constantly spoke to you about, or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yes, because it was the absolute center of their existence. The Academy of Science was going to be closed down by agreement in the treaty, the unification treaty. The Academy of Science, with 26,000 employees, was to be closed on December 31st, 1991. Two-thirds of the people there would be outright dismissed. One-third would be, after being so-called evaluated, would be given contracts, 2 to 3 year contracts, which possibly might be renewed, to either move to a university or to move to a research institute. A couple institutes remained in East Berlin, but most of them were dispersed throughout West Germany. So that's why they were, and of course, socialism had come to an end, and their dream of a socialist world had come to an end, and they were being reviled by most West Germans, not all, but by most West Germans as inferior, not real academics. They'd wasted 40 years under socialism and told, now you have to become, if you want to be successful, you need to become like a West German.
I wanted to ask you about this West German resentment. And most of the people that you interview, you know, make it very clear that they know that they're resented by many in West Germany. How did they deal with that? How did they feel about West Germans? Did they see it as a prospect that was going to make unification a lot harder for them? You know, how do they deal with this?
Okay, well, first of all, two-thirds of the, or three-fourths, I think, I'm not quite sure, but a large majority of the intellectual class of East Germany was utterly opposed to rapid unification. They wanted a process that would take 5 to 10 years. So, and the way they dealt with it, well, a small number of them, at least in my experience, basically, if I can use a colloquialism, they sucked up to the West Germans and would say that they would renounce socialism and go through all these prostrating acts. That, I think, was a small amount. Another group, also rather small, but simply said, I will not renounce socialism. And some of them left the country, and some of them were quite well accomplished in their work. But an unwritten rule of the unification was you had to renounce socialism to get ahead in the unified Germany. And then there were others who just said, well, we lost the Cold War, and this is the way things happen when you lose. You get stigmatized. You don't get to do the stigmatizing. You get stigmatized. And they were very adult about it, is one way to put it. They didn't like it, but they accepted it. And also, you have to realize that I think, I don't remember the exact percentage, but something like 60 or 65% of the people in East Germany had relatives in West Germany. So, it was complicated. And some of them said there were West Germans who understood what was happening to them and were very supportive. But in general, the West Germans, because of the threat to the West German identity, most West Germans looked down upon East Germans as primitive, country bumpkins, feral children, that sort of thing.
Would you say that the majority of the people that you spent time with were true believers in socialism, or sort of socialism because they had no other alternative or they had career goals, you know, that required their sort of support of the party, open support of the party?
Most of them were true believers, although they did not believe in East German socialism by the end. I found very few people who supported the East German state, but most of them, I would say at least 60 to 70%, did believe that socialism was the future of the world. Capitalism would crash, not socialism. So they had many debates about what actually happened, what had really occurred. Okay. But yes, they you can see it in their character, the way they thought about their activities in the world, about other countries. Many West Germans found them inexplicable in their concern for other people and thought it was some kind of ruse they were putting on. But they really had communitarian values, socialist values.
What were some of the reasons they pointed to as to why socialism failed, in East Germany particularly, and maybe more broadly?
Well, they saw East this is a modal description, because there would be people who would disagree. Mm-hmm. But they saw East Germany as a satellite of the Soviet Union. And when Gorbachev came in, they were elated. And then they realized that the East German government, which was composed mainly of men who had fought Stalin, fought for Stalin, fought Hitler in the Second World War, these were old men, basically said to Gorbachev, we will not loosen up. But the fundamental problems were economic and political, but largely economic. And so they saw the beginning demise of the Soviet Union and the loosening up Gorbachev instituted as basically releasing the dam of pent-up frustration. And of course, many East Germans thought there was going to be a third way, that they were going to have a chance, not like Clinton and Tony Blair's third way, but their third way of reviving what they would call a true form of socialism, Some of them even wanted to take aspects of capitalism, which West German communists were appalled at. Mm. But so, you know, it's complicated. But yeah, that's how they saw that.
That's how they saw that. And was there anything in particular that they were excited about in terms of unification? Maybe just as simple as being able to travel to east to west to see their families.
That's about it. Traveling. Most of them felt they had a very clear understanding because they had been trained as socialists. So they thought they would say, sometimes directly, but most of them said, we're being taken over, we're being colonized, this is the way capitalism works. And that's what basically happened to them, actually. So it was a great irony. They had this intellectual worldview of socialism, Marxism, to understand the world, and it was explaining to them what was happening, but what it had failed to do was to say, why were the capitalists taking over and not, why had capitalism not failed? That was a huge, huge problem they had at that time, understanding.
Yeah, I noticed in the interviews that they, you know, that a lot of them talked about how the rush of consumer goods coming into East Germany mm-hmm. had not been good for them.
Yeah.
You know, that capitalism is the, you know, an economy of two-thirds. And I was...
Two-thirds society.
Yeah, a two-thirds society. I was struck by, even though capitalism had sort of won the day, just how confused they were by it.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to ask, you mentioned Francis Fukuyama in your book. And I wanted to know a little bit more about, were they really familiar with his work, The End of History? Did they ask you about it? Did they want to respond to it?
Yes, they did ask about it in one of the classes. Because I would go to these English language classes, and the teacher would, usually for part of the class, they would say, well, we're going to have Professor Bednar speak now, and you're going to hear how an American person speaks English. And this was very valuable to them because the colloquialisms, I would say, they want to know, what does that mean? But one of the requests they made was to give my understanding of Fukuyama. And so we talked about that in one of the classes. And because his thesis was very popular, I think his first article was published in the spring of 1989, and then several months later, the wall falls, and then the book was coming out, and everybody in the West was talking about the end of history. Capitalism has won, communism is defunct, not even worth a discussion anymore, etc. So there was that explicit discussion, you know.
And how did they view his sort of take on it? Did they... Was it scornful almost, or?
No, they were confused. Now, I didn't talk to some of the more high-powered economists and historians, but the people in that class were confused in the sense that they thought he might really be right, and that they had lived these sort of purposeless, meaningless lives for the past 40 years. Although most of them didn't. They actually got into an argument in the class with each other. They started arguing about Fukuyama and whether socialism has failed and why it's failed. But at that time, it was a very confusing topic. Because some said, for instance, socialism didn't fail, the people failed. And, you know, there's that old Bertolt Brecht joke about we're going to dissolve the people, right?
Yeah.
Start over. So, yeah. And some of them said, well, this is really complex. It's too early. One said to me, don't worry, capitalism's going to fail too. It's just going to take a little while longer. So there was a wide variety of opinion about what had happened.
So now I want to switch gears on you just a little bit. Many of the people that you talk about, talk about the role of the Stasi in their lives and how they always they had this sense that they're always being watched. I want to talk about what they told you about life in a police state. I mean, they clearly recognize they lived in a police state. Their feelings about the Stasi, how the Stasi sort of motivated or changed their behavior and their way of life and so on.
Okay. So you want me to say a bit about that?
Yes, please.
Well, I was struck that at the academy, I met a few people who were terrified of the Stasi. And I suspect that at least one of them had been forced to be a spy on his colleagues. But most of the people I met had this sort of, they treated the Stasi like, you know, what we call in America, the third rail. Like, if you avoid it and don't touch it, you're okay. And they knew there were boundaries, and they knew there were things they couldn't do. And like the one lawyer who said, we wrote this report, and my boss, even though he was sick, was called in to change it. And so they knew there were things, places they couldn't go, but most of them had adapted ways to avoid the Stasi, like they would change topics, or the Stasi could come to them, and they could actually say to the Stasi, oh, I really don't want to help you with that, and there would be no repercussions, at least that's what they told me. So it was a very complicated relationship, but they all said, if you got in trouble with the Stasi, you were in very big trouble. Okay? They were all very clear about that, that if you got on the wrong side of them, things could be very, very bad for you. And it would range from some complaining bitterly about what was going on, like one biologist saying, we never talked about real issues, ecological issues, to others saying, I just avoided topics, and I think a few of them were actually Stasi collaborators. No one ever admitted that to me, but I think a few of them were. But they had their ways of coping with that. What impressed me most about them was most of them really viewed themselves as intellectuals and scholars fighting against the system as best they could.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this, particularly the biologist, because that struck me. He was very open about how he felt the state had stifled his research. And I wanted to know more about, was that a common feeling amongst many of the people you interviewed? You know, because they did view themselves, clearly from your interviews, as scientists, as intellectuals sort of first. And I want to know how they, you know, juxtapose that with their life in a more repressive state.
Yes. Well, he was in an applied field. He was a very, very smart man, very passionate man, and he was concerned about ecological destruction, okay? And East Germany did a lot of that with, you know, the coal and the way they, because they were, it was all geared toward economic production. Now, other natural scientists I met, like in chemistry, physics, etc., they said, we had very little contact with the Stasi because they didn't understand what we were doing. They just let us do our work. In the social sciences, of course, those were considered the hot disciplines, and they were fairly tightly controlled. So I heard from them about, you know, women's studies, like one example. There were no real women's studies because there were no problems for women in Germany, you know, things like that. So they were controlled, and philosophy was highly controlled, history. But yet, the ones I met said, well, we were socialists, and we could, and there were ways, there were different times throughout the history of the GDR when certain things could be said that weren't repressed. But the one insight I got from them was that many things could be said inside the institutes in discussion, and the prohibitions or the censorship came in if people tried to publish those things or tried to speak about them outside of the Academy of Science. Then you would get in trouble with the government and the Stasi.
Okay. So I want to sort of make clear to the people listening, like, what kind, how the state, how they function within this state. I think you make a good point that they could have internal discussions about certain issues, but, you know, publishing was the problem. I mean, did they view life in East Germany as sort of living in a real repressive state? What kind of reforms did they want, if any?
Well, that's a good question, because, see, the intellectual class had a very ambivalent status in East Germany. On the one hand, they were privileged because all they had to do was go to the office every day and at the academy, no teaching, no responsibilities, just do research. So there were quite a few people there who did nothing. They just had a job because everybody had a job in East Berlin. But there were many people there who were scholars and were actually trying to do work. And they felt that, toward the end anyway, they felt that they were trying to make a better world through the worldview of socialism. And they didn't, it's just, they knew they were controlled, but they would talk about it with each other, and they knew that some of their colleagues were reporting to the government, to the Stasi, and it also varied from institute to institute, because some of the institutes were run like military institutes, you know, basically by people very tight, very connected to the Stasi, but all institute directors had to be connected to the Stasi, but other institutes were run as academic institutes where there's a lot of intellectual freedom. Now, I don't know what the percentage would be of either or, but I was told that an intellectual's life could be rather pleasant and fulfilling, or rather difficult and not fulfilling and just onerous if one were in one of the militarily run institutes.
You mentioned this in the book as well, their strange place in East German society, because the heroes of socialism are the workers.
Right.
And I want to know if any of them talked to you about relationships they had with workers, either members of their family, friends, did they interact?
I think most of them did not have much interaction with workers, maybe where they lived in some of the apartment buildings. They had great sympathy for the workers. They were constantly telling me, as bad as our situation is, it's going to be far worse for the workers. The workers have really been duped by Mr. Kohl and the West Germans. They're only finding that out now. I'm speaking about in the year 1990 and 91. But I don't think that many of them, like academics anywhere, had a whole lot of working class friends.
And did any discuss experience with you where they had workers openly resenting them for their sort of cushy jobs, their office jobs? They don't have to work in a coal mine or.
Yes, I got that a lot, that the workers viewed them as privileged and sort of, I don't know, effeminate or effete is the word, but not getting their hands dirty, not having to do manual labor, and viewing them as an isolated, privileged class of people.
Okay.
What we call pointy heads here in the United States.
Right. I was sort of struck by or interested to hear your take on that relationship, because you have this group of people who clearly has an affection for the workers as sort of a socialist idea, but I'm not surprised to hear they didn't know a lot of workers.
They traveled in their own circles.
Right. So in your book, you have a number of very, very wonderful interviews with many different characters. I assume the names have been changed, correct?
Only two or three names are real in the book. And those people explicitly ask me to use their real name. Otherwise, the names have been changed.
Okay. Yes. Obviously, we don't have time to talk about them all, but there's a few that I'd like to have you elaborate on. The first is Lily, the teacher of the class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was she like? How did she What was her, how did she teach? What did she really find important about you being there? Because she was very enthusiastic about you being there.
Yeah. Well, the first thing about Lily is that she had really no political views. She was a kind of person who really liked people, was very friendly, and when we talked about socialism, she said, well, that's just the system I grew up under. And she was pretty much an apolitical person. She was extremely friendly. She was about 50 years old at that time. She was quite remarkable because she could speak perfect British English and had never been out of East Germany. She trained herself by listening to the radio and records. And she was always trying to improve her English. She was very well-liked by the students and very helpful. And and she told me anything I wanted to. I asked her once, why don't you, do you think I'm from the CIA? And she said, no, I know you're not, because the way you got here, and you're just, she said, you're just, you don't ask CIA kind of questions. Pretty much what she said.
Why was learning English so important to her?
Yeah, well, she went against the trend because she also knew Russian, of course, because everyone had to learn Russian. But she said she did not like to speak Russian. And she, for some reason, became infatuated as a child listening to the BBC on the radio. And I think she told me, she said to herself, I'm going to learn how to speak that language. And that's what she did. And there was some pressure. You could study English in East Germany, but it wasn't really encouraged. And then once she started to excel at it, then she became valuable to the East German government because she was so good at understanding it and speaking it.
Was there an affinity for American culture? Because one of the things I was also struck by was that how excited you were an American, specifically, not right. British, not, you know, Irish, but an American. I understand they didn't get a lot of Americans traveling to East Germany. But did they view Americans differently than they viewed, say, British? They definitely viewed you differently than they viewed West Germans, but.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because they were trained during the times of the GDR to be highly suspicious of Americans. Americans, of course, the seat of empire and capitalism. And that surprised me that they were so interested. But for whatever reason, and maybe because of the trauma they were going through when I met them and the way I spoke to them and my politics would be recognizable to them as sort of left-wing politics, although I don't consider myself that. But for all those reasons, and the fact that I listened to them and I didn't tell them things, I listened to them, they sort of spread the word among each other that there's this American and he's listening to people. There were some who didn't want to talk to me, a few who just wouldn't even acknowledge my existence, but there were only two or three in each class. So I don't think they in general had a great affinity for Americans, but they certainly wanted to know about American culture. And at the time, many of them thought, you know, it would be America might be someplace they might end up. So your question is good. I don't have a firm answer because it struck me that they were so gracious and outgoing with an American.
Yeah, as I was reading the book, I was struck by that as well. How excited they were. Did it take them a long time to warm up and want to speak with you? I mean, you mentioned the few that wouldn't at all. But generally speaking, was it? I mean, they.
You, no, they were that first class. They were just really enthusiastic. And see, I grew up in an ethnic community, a Polish ethnic community in Detroit. And a lot of the behavior, I think, nonverbal behavior that I saw among the East Germans was very, very familiar to me because there were lots of Polish people who had just come to the United States in Detroit. And I think that there was some kind of nonverbal communication going on there. And then once they would say, oh, I want you to speak to my friend, well, if a friend recommends you, then they're willing to talk. And they would say, he will listen to you. That's the main thing they would say to their friends. He will listen to what you have to say. And they were dying to have someone listen to what they had to say.
Yeah, was there, you know, I was struck by that too, that a lot of the people that you were dealing with in your book were very concerned about getting their stories out. Were they concerned that their stories were going to just be washed away with unification because of, you know, West German attitudes towards them and towards socialism, and, you know, they had lost? So were they worried that their history was going to be swept sort of under the rug?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, you know, it took 25 years, not that I tried for 25 years, but at the time when I tried to get the book published in 92, 93, there were no publishers interested. It was like, well, who cares about what these East Germans think? So yes, I think they felt they wanted to say something that had the chance of being recorded and expressing their views, because no one wanted to hear their views and expressing their take on what their lives had meant, what their lives as DDR citizens had been like.
Did any of them really talk to you about moving to the United States, particularly if they were part of the group of people who lost their jobs? Did they see that as a viable option for them to move, maybe not just the United States, but other parts of the West?
Yes, some did. I met some scientists who were in, I think, what we call robotics, and they were young, and five or six of them at an institute, and they were very different from the others. They had multiple job offers, and some were in the United States, some were in the United Kingdom, and they were all planning to leave the country. Other people were just saying, I want to get out of Germany because I don't feel like a German. I'm an East German. I need to get out of here. That sort of thing. And there were a few who did leave, as I mentioned at the beginning. But they had options. Most of them didn't have options, but some did.
What kind of jobs did the ones that didn't have options, what kind of jobs did they take? I noticed I mean, one of them became cab driver, right? And odd jobs.
So quite a few of them, I'm told, I don't have data on it, they all spoke and wrote good German, which is, you know, it takes a long time with the cases and the genders. When businesses came into East Germany, selling insurance, opening other kinds of businesses, many of them had job opportunities to work in these businesses because their German was so good. So quite a few did that. And again, some left the country. I know some who went into private industry because they were very well trained in math and science. And they were hired at very low wages, which West Germans didn't like, but they were highly trained and they could be hired at low wages. That's sort of a capitalist dream, right? So, and there was this oversupply of people. So that's what happened to them. And again, one third of them were given contracts, but there was a slow attrition. Every 3 years, a few more less would be let go. And my guess is that there weren't that many of all the people who were working in East German universities and at the Academy of Science. There weren't that many who lasted more than 5 or 10 years in the new West German intellectual system. They had to find some other option.
Was that because of conflict with their colleagues, or ideological differences, just an untenable working situation?
I don't know. I think it's probably because there was an oversupply of West German PhDs at that time. And so that was one of the pressures in the East. Oh, there's all these opportunities at the East German universities. And so many of the West German academics with PhDs who were unemployed or underemployed suddenly had full-time faculty positions they could take. So, but why people were dismissed, not given new contracts, there could be a lot of reasons.
Sure.
But certainly there's this undertone of East Germans are inferior, or East Germans are second class. That, and that exists to this day.
Mm, yeah. Mm. Okay, to sort of turn back to the specific individuals, I think the one I found most interesting, and even I found her very charming, was Marie, the library assistant. Can you talk about her character? She was sort of seemingly shy at first, but you really got her to open up and talk to you about a lot of things. Describe to our listeners about her, her background, her family, communists, correct?
Yes. Well, she was interesting, and she knew this because she had grown up in West Berlin, and was a child during the Second World War. I think her father had died probably in the war. And sometime in the early 50s, when she was a teenager, her mother said, we're communist, we're going to move to East Berlin. So all you had to do was move. You know, there was no wall, nothing like that. But this gave her, having been raised in West Berlin and gone to school there for into her teen years, it gave her what she thought was a different perspective on things. And so she always found herself at odds with the East German government. She was very intelligent. I think she spoke three or four languages. She was good in math. And then she wanted to tell me this story about how it was she became this library assistant at this one institute, which was just like a secretarial job. And so she told me about her contact with the Stasi, and in contact with people throughout her education, who one of the criticisms East German bureaucrats would make of people is you don't accept the party line, you think in your own way as an individual, and that's incorrect. So she was ambivalent about the term. She thought it was going to be good for her children, but she was about 50 also, so she thought it was probably too late for her. And I regret I was unable to find her when I went back to Germany. I don't know what happened to her, but I was unable to find her. But she was interesting just because she had lived in West Berlin and come to East Germany, and she never thought about leaving East Germany. She wanted it to become a socialist state.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about generations, because, I mean, one of the things that did strike me about her story was that she actually thought it would be good for her children, even though she was a committed socialist. So a couple of questions, I guess, with this. Were the vast majority of people that you interacted with older, over 45, say?
There was a variety of people. I would probably half or more were in middle age.
Okay.
Most were in middle age, but I did talk to quite a few younger people under 30, and only a few that were quite old, that were near retirement. Most of them were somewhere between 30 and 55, I think.
Would it be safe to assume that the younger people were more willing to give capitalism a shot? Or were they committed? Were they committed socialists themselves? I mean, if it's too general of a thing to say, that's...
Yeah. Well, I think the younger ones knew that their prospects for success, for career success, were far greater, because there was an unwritten rule that if you're over 40, you're not going to be given a job. You just have to go find something else. Your intellectual career is over. And that was pretty steadfastly enforced, unless you had what they call vitamin D, which means you were in an old boy network. So most of the younger ones actually had opportunities. They would joke about it, saying they're going to re-educate us. But they had opportunities to go to West German universities and earn degrees. And of course, they would be subject to re-socialization.
But I guess my question is, were they by and large enthusiastic about it, or no? Were they the same sort of as the older people?
Yeah, they were ambivalent because on the one hand, they knew I have a chance to go and be educated further and to have a career. I'll have a degree from a West German institution. I could have a career, but they didn't want to give up their identity as East Germans. So it posed certain problems for them, but they were certainly, the ones I knew, they weren't going to turn down the opportunity to continue as academics.
Sure, right, because that was their dream.
Right.
Yeah, but I was just curious. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, for Germans, once you start down the academic track, you don't turn back. And this was emphasized to me by quite a few of them, that you don't just say, oh, I left graduate school and I started a business. So if you go into an academic career, you are considered a massive failure if you don't stick with it.
Okay. So, yeah, they have that pressure on them. So, okay. Yeah. So, all right. I was curious as to how the generational differences impacted the way that they viewed the turn. So you went back in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, that there's still, even to this day, some prejudices between West, you know, the Western Germans still view Eastern Germans as somehow a little less. How did the East Germans that you re-interviewed, how have their thoughts on the turn changed in, well, it's 24 years?
Well, most of them felt that that capitalism was a very hard and demanding system. They had, they weren't nostalgic for the GDR, but they had a lot of fond memories of working at the academy. Interestingly enough, because they felt that the presence of the Stasi could be managed in a certain way, but the pressures they were under in the West German system, they found onerous, like constantly looking for new contracts, to 3-year contracts to continue their careers, or if they were in, like, one was at Potsdam University, she said, I teach about social inequality, and I have to be extremely careful about the way I present it in the classes. It's almost like being back in DDR times, watching what you have to say. So they were very keen about saying that the Western system has, a scientific academic system has problems, and they're not really that different from what's happened in the GDR, which is quite amazing kind of comment, but that's how they felt. And most of them have positive feelings about what the GDR was about and negative feelings about the status of Germany right now, you know.
Did they do a lot of talking about current German politics?
Well, only to say that most of the issues that were swept under the rug about unification remain under the rug. For instance, the displacement of people in the eastern part of Berlin, in what was East Berlin. They've been, you know, forced out due to gentrification. That is rising rents that they can't afford, other issues like there are no laws protecting people from being discriminated against for being East Germans. There was a famous case where a woman was rejected for a job and they wrote on her application, she's rejected, she's an East German, and somehow she got a hold of that and launched a lawsuit, and typical German law, the Supreme Court said, yes, you were discriminated against, but there's no law protecting you from being discriminated against, so nothing's going to be done. And this, of course, these Germans, you know, really angry, right? Well, yes, you were discriminated against, but so what? So they've accommodated to it. They certainly accommodated to it. They all feel like Germans now, like it's their country. They don't have that problem of feeling I can't say I'm a German, but they all have a great deal of this nostalgia for what East Germany was in terms of feelings of solidarity and aspiring to have a socialist world. But one of their main criticisms is the West is about making money and not much more, you know. And this just it's no longer inconceivable to them, but almost to a person, they said, living 25 years under capitalism has made them realize how bad capitalism is. In fact, one of them in the book said to me, I really liked capitalism until I had to live under it. He was in East Germany. He said, I liked it, but now that I've lived under it, it's really not a good system.
Interesting. And did any of them discuss with you their feelings on Angela Merkel?
Some of them knew her. They just see her, well, basically they see her as a politician. She's an opportunist, nice person personally, but an opportunist who never really was a socialist. You know, her family is evangelical, and she was a member of the CDU in East Germany, which actually was allowed. So they don't view her as one of them, really. She's just, at least this is my opinion, she's just someone who happened to be born and lives in East Germany, but she really wasn't, as they were, East Germans. Her degree was in physics, and they just see her as a typical kind of politician.
Okay, so no strong feelings on her one way or another.
No, nobody, they didn't really talk much about her. It's just like that's who she is, and they understand, you know, what politicians do and, you know, how she became, you know, I don't know if you know the story, I won't go into it, but, you know, how did she get where she was and you know, sort of undermining Helmut Kohl at one point and stepping forward and all that. They didn't spend much time talking about her to me. In fact, none of them even mentioned her as best I can recall.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious. That was just a curiosity.
Of course, yeah. She's East German.
Right, because she's East German and she's a scientist, and, you know, these are the people you're talking to. So for everybody listening, what are one or two things that you want them to take away from your book? It's a really fascinating book. It deals with a really fascinating question. And so I'm wondering what for you are the big things to take away from.
Okay, well, let's see. I would say, first of all, because this will bring us to what my next project is that I'm working on now. There are certain, I think, universal ways people have of dealing with each other. And what happened there, so sometimes I say to people, what do you think would have happened if capitalism failed and the East Germans had taken over? Well, pretty much the same kinds of treatment. It would have been the West Germans who were stigmatized and the West Germans who were seen as, you know, feral children and country bumpkins. So there's that sociological dynamics, which I get into in the third part of the book, that victors, you know, treat the vanquished in a certain way, and it's not a good way. Secondly, the issues that were unresolved 25 years ago by the unification have not been resolved, and there's a great deal of resentment among East Germans about the way this happened. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think it's being transmitted to their children, because the West Germans certainly felt, well, once this generation of East Germans dies out, everybody will think of themselves as Germans, and then East Germany will just be a memory, but it won't have any, you know, social significance in the consciousness of people. And I think that is not true, because if you look at the economic status of the former East German states, you know, they're not doing well. And, you know, the AfD, right, the Alternative for Germany, that political movement, it's got its strength in East Germany. So I can't go into it. We can't go into it now. I understand. But I think some of that can be traced, and perhaps a large part of it can be traced, to the fact that the unification was really badly handled. The East Germans were basically told, shut up, you are now part of Germany, and the West Germans will decide. And, you know, things come back to haunt you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, those are the, and I think I say in the book, what the East Germans want the West Germans to know is that they badly insulted them and badly mismanaged the unification process, and these issues remain unresolved and remain points of conflict in the society.
Yeah, and I think that's a great and important point for people listening, because you look at Germany now and you travel to Germany now, if you're not paying attention to those kinds of things, you wouldn't even notice.
That's right.
Right. You know, you see them as one country, unified country.
Yeah.
And it's I think it's important to know that, you know, these issues are still there, and they do contribute to things like the alternative for Germany. I think that those are important takeaways. So now that this project is done, what are you working on currently?
Okay, so the book I'm working on now, and I'm actively working on, I just got back from Detroit. It's about Detroit, and it's called Whose City Is This? An Ethnographic Account of the Battle for the Future of Detroit. Because just like East Germany, West Germany, there, you know, Detroit was obviously went into significant decline, and now there are various groups trying to lay claim to the future of the city. And there's a great deal of activity going on there, because 40% of the city's not there anymore, it's burned down. And so there are just a number of factors going on, you know, things about ethnicity, race, whose city, and so this issue, whose city is this, is really resonating with the people I'm meeting, because there's a 7.2 square mile area downtown, which is being so-called redeveloped, a renaissance, and it's basically, you know, this concept, the creative class,
mm-hmm.
that concept?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's invite creative class people in here, and let's do finance, and let's have a lot of boutiques. We can sell fancy clothes and restaurants and gentrify the city. That's that Detroit. And then there's another part of Detroit where you have lots of poor people, lots of land, and saying, once again, we're being isolated, left behind. We want to have a say about the city. And Detroit, many Detroiters, because it's over 80% African Americans, consider Detroit the black capital of America, like a Mecca. And they feel very disenfranchised. And so there's a lot of conflict and anger there about where the city goes. So that's the project I'm working on now.
Well, it sounds fascinating, and I hope when you're done, no pressure, you'll come back on the show and talk with us about it, because I think it would be fascinating to hear more about, especially someone who lives in Washington, D.C., and sort of there's these kind of issues that go on here as well. I want to thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed your book. I hope everybody listening enjoyed the talk, and we will see everybody next time.